This is the Ritz and Hewers podcast.
And if you ever wondered whether salmon, the colour, was still in, Bill O'Shea this evening is resounding proof that it is still a dynamic colour choice. And he's joined by a very nicely shirted Dr. Nick Carr. Good evening, Ritz and Hewers.
Lovely to see you.
I must say,
you do rock the salmon.
Well, it's good that I'm on radio. That's all I can say.
No, I think it gives you a softness that you, you know, internally do not have.
Oh, yeah, or externally even. Externally, no. And, I mean, it's great that we're hearing Nick's mother tonight. Nick's mother's 89. She's going to come on. She's still a practicing psychologist.
Yes.
Mine's 98, and I think I might bring her in next week.
You know what? I love a mum coming in. I love mums, as long as it's not my mum. Yes, there's nothing better than a mum.
I wasn't quite sure how the ABC would feel about having my mum on the radio.
If she talks like you do, then we're going to love her.
You like the BBC newsreaders, you lot.
I like to – my diction is very important, and I learned it all from my mother, so you'll hear that in about 20 minutes.
Now, I've got a beef, Jacinta.
Oh, how surprising.
A complaint.
I'm so surprised,
I was just
Bill.
Informed outside that the shingles vaccine is going on the PBS, and I only shelled out for the shingles vaccine a few months ago.
I'll put your mind at rest, Bill, because you are far too young to qualify for the freebies. But this is actually vital news for Australians, because on the 1st of November, this year, the shingles vaccine, which previously, if you want to get it, cost about $250.
I can vouch for that.
$250 isn't much to not get the shingles, but it's a lot of money to pay for a vaccine. 1st of November, it becomes free, so long as you are 70 years or older.
Oh, so it's academic.
Why is that? Is shingles very dangerous in that age range?
It's just more common and more nasty in the older people. They had to have a cut off somewhere. It's a lot of money to spend on a vaccine. But shingles is a nasty disease. You can get it actually at any age. Curiously, my daughter's boyfriend, who's only in his 20s, just got it on his kneecap.
How does a vaccine happen, though? Because isn't that born in you through a whole other process much earlier on?
A good question. So, Bill, I'm going to test you here because you know this sort of stuff. Where does shingles come from?
Well, I thought it came from your cerebrospinal fluid. So, you know, there's fluid in your spine.
That's pretty good. Yeah,
it lies dormant.
Yeah, lies dormant after what?
Chickenpox.
Chickenpox. Yeah. Very good. So that's exactly right.
How did you know how to say that, Bill?
Yeah. Because when I had the vaccine, the GP explained it.
You listened to him.
But it's quite stunning because it's been there for all of us since we were children,
The chickenpox is one of the so-called herpes group of viruses. And there's this old joke, what's the difference between herpes and true love? Herpes lasts forever. Because when you get one of those viruses, it stays in the body. It stays in the system. It sits there quietly, not doing anything at all, just lying dormant for years, maybe even decades. And then something triggers the virus to reactivate. And chickenpox, which is, we don't see it so much these days because we vaccinate against chickenpox. But for people who are old enough to remember, chickenpox, nasty, spotty disease all over the body often. When it comes back as shingles, it comes back in just one part of the body, on one side of the body, in what's called a dermatome, just one part of skin. So it can happen on the face, happen on the trunk, any part of the body, but just one isolated part.
And does it come back because, like skin cancers, as you get older, your immune system doesn't work so well to keep it under control?
Yes, your immune system, the immune level to that virus has dropped, and for one reason or another it comes out. It's often thought to be associated with stress and that sort of thing, which may be the case. But actually the commonest group I see shingles in are perfectly healthy people. They've just dropped their antibody levels and out it comes.
This is an ignorant question. Beware. How can we vaccinate against something that is already dormantly lying in our body?
Good question.
That's a brilliant question.
I like being with you guys.
Yeah, no, that's it. And I thought exactly the same thing. How can you vaccinate? We've already got this disease in our body. The point is we're stimulating our immune system to increase the level of antibodies to keep that little beast dormant. So that's all we're doing. We're just keeping it at bay.
My GP said that it doesn't prevent you getting shingles, but if you do get it in the future, you'll have a lighter dose of shingles.
It reduces your risk of getting shingles, so it does reduce the risk very considerably. If you get it, it's likely to be a much less nasty version. Mm. Correct.
And so it's very significant. And it's really up to people like you, GPs in practice, to tell their patients about it. I didn't even know there was a shingles vaccine.
Well, it's a little bit vexed to say to people, oh, do you know there's this lovely new vaccine? By the way, it costs you $250 bucks. Mm. So we do find it's like the new meningococcal B vaccine for babies. Wonderful vaccine, rare disease, $160 bucks a pop. It's difficult to recommend these for people who maybe financially this would be a difficult thing to do.
How long does the vaccine last, the shingles vaccine?
We think that the vaccine gives you good extra immunity for at least 10 years. So we're hoping to vaccinate people at 70. That's all they need.
No, we hope that they have to go another one at 80.
Thank you.
Dr. Nick, we are talking the shingles vaccine. If you are over 70, it's probably worth going and have a chat with your doctor if you feel like you'd like to boost your immunity.
But remember, it's going to be free on the list after the 1st of
November.
If you're under 70, then pay for it. It's well worth having. If you're approaching 70, maybe wait till the 1st of November.
Coming up very soon, these two are going to get on their soapbox. Bill O'Shea and Dr. Nick Carr join us this evening for Writs and Cures. And as usual, there is a soapbox moment, and it involves public notary. Talk to us about this.
Well, I just thought it's time I exposed the public notary system in Victoria. Not many people seem to know much about it because I'm often approached to witness documents and they say, are you a notary? And of course I'm not. And so they say, well, don't worry, I can witness it for you. But sometimes you can't because it's required for an overseas document. So someone in, if you're applying for a foreign passport or whatever it might be, where there's overseas trade transaction or bank transfer, sometimes you have to, because of the overseas requirement, get a notary to witness it. So I thought, well, who are these notaries? How are they controlled? And of course, up until 2002, guess who appointed public notaries in Victoria? I'll give you a packet of lifesavers.
Oh, I really want to work for this.
If you can tell me without remembering what I've told you in the notes.
without reading it, I would have assumed it would have been some high official of the law in somewhere in Victoria.
It's one of your countrymen, actually. One of your fellow country of origin
prince?
People. The Archbishop of Canterbury.
What?
Yeah. What a great quiz night question. No one would know that, would they? What on earth is the Archbishop of Canterbury doing appointing public notaries in Victoria? That's what happened. In fact, the Archbishop of Canterbury appointed all public notaries. It probably goes back to Henry VIII or some, you know, when they had, I mean, there's such a merger of church and state in Britain anyway that it's not surprising. So that's what happened until 2002. And there was a society of notaries, or there still is, that controlled how many were allowed to be appointed. So it's just like one of your medical colleges or the bar where they restrict entry quite happily to keep the numbers down so there's more work for the boys and girls who are already in the club.
It doesn't sound like hard work. Like it's not going to take long.
Reading and signing your name.
Yeah.
Yeah, not that hard, really.
Just,
Yeah. So to do it, you have to be a lawyer. And so what happened in 2002, the government took it back and said, look, enough of the Archbishop of Canterbury. And the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court now appoints them. And it's controlled under its own legislation in Victoria, the Notaries Act. And there are rules for who can be a public notary. You have to be a practitioner, a legal practitioner, lawyer. You've got to have a full practicing certificate. You've got to have, I think, 5 years' experience. And you've got to pass an exam. And of course, there's only one university that offers the notaries exam, and that is Victoria University in Melbourne. So they've got a monopoly. There's a nice little earner for VU. So you go to VU and you do the notaries course, and then you go off to the Victorian Admissions Board, VLAB, Victorian Legal Admissions Board, and you say to the board, I want to become a notary, and you produce your qualification and you show that you're a lawyer of 5 years standing, and you get admitted as a notary. And then you can charge people to witness their documents.
So, Bill, let me ask you, because as a GP, I often have people bringing documents in that they want me to certify as true copies of originals. Mm-hmm. They want me to sign various things, and I don't get paid a cent for doing this.
No.
So what's the difference between what a notary can do and what your ordinary old street front GP can do?
Not much at all. Right. In fact, the law prohibits the charging to witness affidavits It says you're not allowed to charge
just
for
as well
them.
I don't then. Oh. Unwittingly complying well, with the law. Yeah.
Lucky you said that on the radio as yeah. well.
I think there might be a few listening in who don't understand that and who might perhaps now change their ways. But, I mean, it's understandable. If you're hogging the chemist, you know, you're taking up, you walk in with, you know, 50 documents and you distract the chemist for an hour, you might expect to pay something for the trouble that he's going through or she's going through. But in fact, it normally doesn't cost you anything. So what are the things you take to the chemist or the doctor or the local police officer above the rank of sergeant or to a solicitor or a local government councillor? Well, if you want to get something certified as a true copy. So if you've got a power of attorney and you want to give it a copy to the bank say, we don't take your original, get a copy, photocopy and have it certified. So someone looks at the original, looks at the copy and writes on the copy, this is a true copy of the original that I have seen and signs it. And the person who does that is usually one of the people, such as a solicitor or a chemist or a doctor, who will do that. That's the first thing. So certifying is the first thing that commonly happens. Now, of course, notaries can do this too. But of course, notaries you only have to go to, because they charge, if you require a certified copy by a notary due to overseas requirements, because sometimes overseas authorities won't accept a doctor or a chemist or an Australian lawyer. They require a notary because they're a universal group.
We've got a question here. What is the difference between a notary and a justice of the peace?
Oh, well, justice of the peace is a sort of a court officer who can take bail hearings and do all sorts of things like that. And they are authorised to do what a chemist and a doctor can do. But a justice of the peace can't replace a notary either. A notary is a worldwide club of organisation of people who can witness documents and are internationally recognised. So if a notary in Kenya operates, anyone in any other country in the world will recognise the Kenyan notary as being a valid authentication of
a
signature.
Well, doesn't that make sense? Don't we need sort of an international recognised, consistent behaviour, especially when we're talking about documents that might have international issues?
Only if you need to. I think only if you need to.
So do they have some sort of secret stamp which is only available to a notary?
They have a seal.
Like a secret handshake?
They have a seal. They do.
So it's obvious to anyone in the world where the document has been signed by a notary as opposed by a GP or a chemist.
That's correct. And they have a nice big certificate on the wall. Now, I'll tell you, so as I say, you could go to the chemist or the local GP or to me or to any other legal practitioner or police sergeant. But if, for example, it's to certify a copy with a notary, I'll just read you the charging. To prepare and complete a notarial certificate certifying one individual copy of up to 5 pages, the fee is $130.
What?
It's half the cost of a vaccine for shingles.
10 pages and you've been vaccinated.
$130 for 5 pages certifying it's a true copy. How long does it take you to certify it's a true? How long does it take you to check that a 5-page document is a true copy? Not very long.
Seems very consistent with lawyer fees, though. I'm doing a little eyebrows at you right now.
Lawyer fees in the dark. Way behind. I'll give you another example. Administering an oath. Right. Now, you've got to administer an oath carefully with an affidavit. The coppers got into some trouble a few years ago because they didn't administer oaths properly, and a whole lot of people got off charges because the writs hadn't been executed properly.
So you're going to have to explain for an ignoramus like me, what's a written administration of an oath? Who would do
well,
that?
Well, if you want to make an affidavit, in other words, you're in court and you want to make a statement to the court that's sworn, so you're saying it's true or affirmed, you need to swear it or affirm it in front of a person authorised to take that your signature. And that's a much tighter group than the stat deck people, which I'll come to in a minute. So the affidavit group are lawyers and court officials and police officers above sergeant. And there's a certain words you've got to go through. You've got to say to them, is this your name and handwriting? And then you've got to say, repeat after me, I hereby sincerely and truly declare and affirm that this is my name and handwriting and the contents of my affidavit is true and correct. And they've got to repeat that and they've got to sign it. Well, lawyers do that all the time, all right? And we don't charge for that. But a notary charges $85 for you to go in and do that. So,
well, compared to 5 pages, that sounds like a bargain.
Yeah, it's much cheaper than certifying. And certifying 2 to 5 copy documents is $170. So, you know, it does get pricey. If you've got a lot of documents, if you're emigrating, let's say, I mean, I used to see a lot of doctors, particularly anaesthetists, who are emigrating to Canada because it's very hard to get jobs as anaesthetists in Australia, in Victoria particularly. It's a gross oversupply of anaesthetists, and they go to overseas. Well, the Canadian medical authorities required, you know, lots of documents to be witnessed, and some of those were by notaries, and I had to send them away and say, you've got to go away and find a notary. And there's a list of notaries that the Law Institute publishes.
How many are hanging around since it's a tight
group? I'm not sure how many are in. I should have found that out, actually, but there's not a large number. You can look them up in the Law Institute website. There's a list of them, and they're scattered around the suburbs and in some are in the country. So we've talked about certifying copies, swearing and affirming court documents, affidavits, and the third and most common is the statutory declaration. That's when you're way sick and the boss wants you to sign a stat deck that you were really sick, because if you sign a statutory declaration and make it falsely, you're liable for perjury, as you are with an affidavit, criminal offence. So it does carry a lot more weight. And I always recommend if you're on a parking dispute with the council or with the traffic camera and you think you're innocent, it's always a good idea when you put in your defence to put it in as a statutory declaration, because you're reinforcing that you're telling the truth. You're prepared to take the risk on perjury, so you must be telling the truth.
So who witnesses a stat deck?
Now, a vast number can witness stat decks. Virtually, you know, lots of people. You know, obviously the usual suspects, chemists and doctors, but even some public servants can witness them. Now, they're all easy to find if you Google who can witness them. But, of course, so can notary. Public notaries.
Cost of? I'm sure it's on your
$3,000.
Well, we're down to, I think we're down around the $130 mark for that too.
Wow.
So, yeah. So if you don't need a notary public, why would you go to
one? Why don't you become one?
Be a good little retirement earner.
I think you should do that.
You'd have to promote yourself as someone who's really good at reading one document and looking at another and making
actually,
sure
we might
same.
Struggle. So sorry to have given you that high bar. You've also been slapped down. Please don't refer to pharmacists as chemist Bill. Thank you. Coming up very soon.
They've never done chemistry. It's too hard
Nick,
for them.
We're about to meet the greatest woman in your life, and possibly she will be a great one in ours. Dr. Janet Carr joins us very soon.
This is the Ritz and Hewers podcast.
Bill O'Shea and Dr. Nick Carr join us on Ritz and Cures this evening. And our special guest on Ritz and Cures tonight is Dr. Janet Carr. Apart from having the distinction of being Dr. Nick's mum, which we'll find out more about very soon, Janet is a clinical psychologist from the UK who has a special interest in intellectual disability. She's completed the world's longest ever study on a group of people with Down syndrome from babies to the age of 50. And what's more, for the first 47 years, she did this study on her own. Last year, she was hit by a car and broke her hip, but recovered enough to get to the Windsor Castle to receive an OBE from the Queen in honour of her work. Now at the ripe old age of 89, she's just arrived in Melbourne and has just presented the final part of her research at a major conference, the International Association for the Scientific Study of Intellectual and Developmental Disabilities. And goodness gracious, she sits right before us now. Good evening, Dr. Janet.
Good evening.
So wonderful to have you here. We are mostly astounded, not only by your study, but you have birthed Dr. Nick, and you did yes. a pretty good job.
I think I did.
I'd have to agree with that. Yes.
Concur. Bill, yes. Your feelings on such matters?
I think it's the best member of the family I've met so far, to be honest.
And the only. Now, tell us a little bit about the conference that you were just at. What was it like after this amount of time, this great study that you've done, that you presented the final part of it to this?
Yeah, well, it took all of 15 minutes, so it wasn't very extensive, and there wasn't a terrific lot I could say about it, but I just did the best I could with it.
So, Janet, this is a bit like 7-Up, Michael Apted's film, isn't it? You followed 50 Down syndrome children from birth.
Pretty much.
Every so many years, and now they're 50 years old.
Yes.
Is that right?
That's right. It varied quite a lot. The first 4 years, I saw them 7 times. That was quite often. And then there were big gaps because I never knew that I was actually going to do it again. It all just happened when it did. So after 4 years, I saw them at 11 when I just found an opportunity to see them again. Then I moved to St. George's Hospital to work there, and the psychiatrist there said, oh, you must see them at 21. So, okay, I did.
All 50.
Well, no, some of them had died by that time. I did lose some. Only 4 of them, not by death. So that's a quite a low attrition rate for that kind of study. Usually people do drop out and they aren't found, but I was quite relentless in pursuing them.
So you've had to pursue them all over the British Isles, presumably?
Yes, so fortunately not Scotland, but certainly Wales, Ireland, all over everywhere, yes, and it's all to northern England and so on. So yes, there was a lot of travel.
Look out the window and see your car coming up the road and think, oh, no, here she comes again.
Yes, here she comes again.
I want to know, what was the reason, what was the beginning point for you for this study? Why did you want to study Down syndrome?
Right. Well, I didn't in particular. I had been doing general child and adult psychology, and then I was invited to take part in this study. And what struck me then was that this was going to fit in very well with my situation as the mother of three small children aged between 8 and 5. And I thought, well, you know, if one of those has a speech day or a sports day or something, I'll just make an appointment, because I was making my own appointments. I'll make an appointment for another day and they'll never miss out, and nor will the children. And that turned out to be completely right. That was worked out very well.
So you how did you recruit the members of the study?
Yeah. Well, I wasn't responsible for that. That was done by the people who'd started, which was the Psychiatric Genetics Research Unit, the Institute of Psychiatry in London. And they set up the study to recruit a year's intake of births of children with Down syndrome from one defined geographical area, the county of Surrey and two areas of southeast London, Camberwell and Lewisham, and over one calendar year. So that was the decision.
Has that remained, that group? That's
pretty
much. Did you
much.
Find some more from elsewhere?
Actually, yes, we did. We weren't supposed to, but we did.
Right. And how did you do that?
I don't know. They did it. I
didn't. Oh, they did it.
Yes. I just had the babies come to me. I was just referred them, you see. Yeah. So I wasn't responsible.
But a very important part was that you also had families, control families, who had babies who didn't have Down syndrome, so that you could compare the families who had Down syndrome babies with families with babies without Down syndrome.
That came a little later. Yes, I decided to do that because I thought this would be an interesting point, particularly because at that time, a family with a disabled child was reckoned to tear the family apart. The fathers skipped off, the mothers were overwhelmed, the eldest daughters were overwhelmed, and everybody had a horrible time. So I started doing this, and this is truly what I expected to find, and I didn't. I found the families pretty okay, functioning really quite well. There were some handicaps, some difficulties, particularly the mothers, as they got older, couldn't do the work they wanted to because they always had to be home for the children coming back. So they were quite limited in the sort of work that they could do. But apart from that, the families functioned, as one American writer said, more like than different, like to than different from the ordinary families in the general run. They really were okay.
What was the mode of your study? Did you observe? Was it about observation? Or what were you looking at?
Oh, I was giving psychological tests. Uh-huh. And these started with tests of infants. I had to learn how to do that. And basically, they didn't really give you a very good answer. They were pretty ropey, really. I mean, they were as good as they could be, but they didn't predict what a child would be like very well.
Was there many other studies happening at the same time in that same sort of age group?
Well, they came along later. People got very keen on this. In particular, they always thought that they would be able to do, as they said, early intervention and make the babies function beautifully because they'd been had this early stimulus. That actually didn't work out. One of my co-workers, somebody I knew very well and who had actually started his study because he thought mine was so interesting, says she modestly, and he had done an early intervention study looking at some who had and some who hadn't had the intervention, and he did this for 2 years. Then he left them alone for 3 years and went back and tested them again, and the two lots of children were much the same.
So is it to test whether early intervention can improve the ability of these children to function, or is it to also test the family relationships between the parents and the children and the siblings?
No, this was entirely to test how the child was developing.
Right. And whether interventions would make a difference.
Well, what they were looking at was whether that having done all this intervention early on, the children then went ahead and were fine afterwards, but they didn't.
And this, of course, is a very, very difficult message in any field of disability to say that intervening early, which, of course, is every parent's desire to get in and do things, and to say that longer term there was no evidence of benefit. I guess we have to be cautious. These were particular studies. It doesn't cover every study of every type of early intervention. So I don't want parents out there with kids with intellectual disability or other forms of handicap to think we're saying that early intervention is globally no use. But it's just a very important point that there were studies in the earlier phases of Down syndrome showing, and unfortunately, that early intervention didn't have a lasting benefit.
What it did was give the parents something to do, and that was quite important. It gave them, they felt that they were helping their child, and that was in itself quite important, though in fact it didn't really do anything in the long run, as I said.
Over this 50-year span, you would have also obviously seen a whole lot of cultural shift around perceptions of disability. What's your experience of that been?
That's absolutely right. There were a lot, and I just had to see what was happening at the time. I don't think it really made a great difference to my group, but it was always one of the things I had to take into account.
But have you seen a change in attitude in society towards intellectual disability?
I think I have, yes. I think this has been quite positive for the people who have got the disability. What I think it hasn't done really is make a huge difference to the tenor of their life. They tend not to be, at the moment, as you probably know, there is this idea that they should all live in the community, which means they live in small houses with three or four other people. That means they're quite limited in how much they are able to interact with other people of their own kind. And I don't think they don't really interact with the community very much. They see the postman and the milkman and those people, but they don't really have very much real contact with
them. Is that because they're living with other people with Down syndrome, or because they're not living with people with Down syndrome?
They're not necessarily with Down syndrome,
no,
but with a learning disability. Yes,
okay,
they are.
So there could
but
be
I don't
various
think
causes.
It's that stops them, really. It's just that they don't get out and mix. Very few of them do. A few have really been able to join other clubs and sports facilities and that sort of thing.
What about the ones who live at home with their family until they're quite, you know, mature age?
That was better for them, because particularly the other siblings would often take them out to the events. I remember one boy who was always taken off to cricket matches by his brother. Mm. And once he had to move away from that no longer happened.
Mm. And are there different degrees of disability that Down syndrome babies can have?
Oh my goodness, yes. Mm. This is one of the things that struck me most forcibly, how wide a variety of people there are. They range across a great range of ability, some who are really quite able and quite active and able to take part in all sorts of things, and some who really can't do much at all and have to be looked after and most things done for them. And that is quite a big thing, and it's lovely for the families when they have one of these bright, able people who can participate in family life to that way. Mm. I'm not sure that it's always to the advantage of the person with Down syndrome, because although they can do a lot, they can see that their siblings, I remember one girl particularly, had two older sisters, and they were going out, having boyfriends, going to dances, going to this, going to that. And this girl, who was pretty capable, really, she could see she was never going to do that.
Mm.
And so it's not necessarily a better thing for them, I think. Sometimes the ones who are not so aware of what they're missing are happier, I think.
I want to go back to some of the earlier findings and just to reinforce what you said earlier, because it was a crucial understanding for me, because I was taught when I was a medical student that having a disabled child, literally those words you said, tears families apart. And it was your research that was the first concrete evidence, statistical proof, if you like, that this simply wasn't true.
Yeah.
Which I found terribly, terribly important and an immensely important piece of information to be able to talk to parents about. But I'm interested to know, because I remember you saying a couple of things. One was about how the parents were told about their child's disability. Do you want to say a little bit about what your findings were there?
Yeah, that was a nice thing. That was one of the first things I did when I went to see the families when the babies were 6 weeks old. I did a quite structured interview with them, asking them about how they were told, how the doctor told them, and what they would have liked to have happened. And that made quite a big impact, because what we found was that they wanted very much to be told the truth. They wanted to be told early. They didn't want to be left, as some mother said, that awful business of finding out for yourself. They never did just find out for themselves. Gradually, that was the idea.
Really?
Yes, yes. And they didn't. They got the idea there was something wrong, and then they pestered everybody. Tell me, is there something wrong with me? Oh, sorry, we aren't allowed to tell you.
How long was that in play for? How long did
it,
that...
It seems extraordinary now, doesn't it?
But, it's a shocking...
But when Janet, I find it hard to say my mum.
Can you say my mum? Can we have more of that tonight?
When my mum began this study back in 1963, the prevailing wisdom was that you didn't tell these mothers. You would distress them. There was some reason. This thing that you said that they wanted the truth, they wanted it early, and they didn't want any mucking
about.
Yes,
the other thing, the other idea was that they would get to bond with this baby without knowing there was anything wrong with it. Well, they didn't. And all that was
so it just seems so obvious now that it's nonsense that they didn't want the truth and so on. But back then, that's what people did. They obfuscated, they delayed.
Because
and they
the perception
waited.
Was the news was so devastating.
Right.
And again, in reiterating that the findings found it's not. It
and
wasn't.
When my mum wrote this up, I can say my mum proudly here, and published papers about this, it changed practice because it meant people suddenly sat up and took notice and said, oh, we actually need to tell these people. Wow.
Dr. Yes. Nick, when you were going through your school and becoming a doctor, were you already aware of the findings of your mothers before? You know, were you having to kind of advocate for a different way throughout your schooling?
It was rather lovely, really, because we grew up knowing about this study. We knew about Down syndrome in a general sense because we would hear mum talking about this. And while we didn't know who these people were, we knew something about the study and the experiences. So it certainly generated a lot of interest at home and certainly piqued my interest for when I was a medical student, yes.
So when you did the 50-year, which was what, last year or the year before, whenever it was, a couple of years ago?
15.
Did you administer tests to those 50-year-old Down syndrome people?
The test had to change over time because you can't give the same test to infants that you can to adults. So,
and the results are the same, though. The upshot of it all is the same, is it?
Pretty much, yes. I mean, from age two, the tests were very strongly correlated with each other, so they did predict how the children would turn out. And from 21, I used the same tests all the way through, from 21 to 50.
And measured any change in...
Yes, that was the idea, to see how they changed. And, of course, you did see that. And even the ones who were really pretty okay went off a bit. And I reckon that if they gave those kinds of tests to us, we would be going off a bit too.
Yeah, I remember my mother's ACAS assessment. They asked her to count backwards from 107 in eights. I thought, thank God they haven't asked me to do this.
I can't even make the first cut of that.
It's totally outrageous. And I'm going to say a word giraffe. And in 8 minutes, I'm going to ask you what that word was. Well, no way did I remember the giraffe in 8 minutes after
did
that.
Did you admit yourself, so, Bill?
Yeah, you just didn't want to stick your neck out.
It's a problem for us. So, Jen, how did you – you must have been a fair age when you did the 50. How did you manage to track them down? You would have been in your 80s, early 80s.
I started off – when I stopped at age four, I thought that's the end of that, you see. But then I wonder if I actually did because I sent them all – Christmas cards. And I've done that ever since.
Christmas cards.
Every year. Cards.
Everyone, yes.
Oh, this is a story in itself, isn't it? I want to travel back and read all those cards. Because those relationships that you must have built over that time, there must be some really special people that you met.
That's absolutely right, yes. And fortunately, sometimes I've been able to give some real help to families when they've needed. I've always been available for that. that we've been very pleased to be able to do that, if I could. Yes, we have had very strong relationships. When we had, I think Nick knows about this too, we, at the end of the 50-year study, it was proposed to us that we had a party. And we had some difficulty deciding where to have this. And then a friend of mine in the House of Lords said, well, have the House of Lords.
Oh,
as you do.
Just casual. Place to throw knees up.
Right.
So we had this party in
fancy
the House.
Fancy dress party in the House of Lords, I imagine.
Anyway, not fancy on. Dress. No. But 10 of the people with Down syndrome came. I invited all of them, but 10 came. And at the end of the party, one of them came up and said, he's called Freddie. And he said, I want to say something. So I said, all right. And I gave him the microphone. And he said, my mum says we'll miss you, Janet Carr.
Oh, isn't that
nice?
Good old Freddie.
Yeah.
Yes.
And you had some help getting around to see them on the 50th.
I had help from Nick, yes.
So you want to explain what that's all about, the young Dr. Carr?
Well, yes, it's slightly embarrassing to say this, but when mum was doing the 45-year study, she told me the hardest thing was getting round to see these people because she couldn't hire a car because she was too old, and so getting to see the person in Ireland was getting hard and finding her way around. So I made the rash promise. I said, if you're still alive when these people are 50, I think fat chance of that. But if you're still alive, I will fly back from Australia and I will be your chauffeur. I will take you to see the ones that are. And to my absolute horror, 2013 comes up. She's still kicking. She's fine. So I fulfilled my promise. I flew back and I drove her to the Isle of Wight and to outer ghastly suburbs of London. And we flew to Ireland and hired a car to see one person. We actually had a magnificent time.
I was going to say, yeah. I mean, you know, but surely for you as well, it would have been a real thing to go around with your mum to finish off a study that she had been, that had been part of your life
as well. It was a real privilege and it was great fun. And I was delighted to be able to help do it. And we ought to just touch on, because this was the study when they were 50 years old. There were only 27 still alive at this point, out of the original 54.
Yes.
What was the crucial finding in this 50-year follow-up?
Well, I think one of the major things that I saw was that it wasn't only the ones who had some sort of early dementia who were losing some of their skills. The others did as well. That was one of the major ones, I think. And another one was that they were, at that time, still having quite an interesting time at their homes. Most of them were not living with their families, but some of them were. There were about 12 who still lived with one or other parent. Only one lived with both parents. And
who picks up the care when the parents become too old to do it?
Oh, it has to be, if the parents can't do it and none of the siblings want to do it, it means services of some sort or another.
They can't live independently even when they're
older. Some can, but none of mine has. And it is quite hazardous and quite troubling for the parents because the services change, people turn over, the staff don't stay and people turn over. And it's a constant worry for the parents once the people go into care. They've never really rest easy after that.
And one of the findings from the 50-year follow-up has been, and other people have confirmed this, the high rate of dementia in the Down syndrome group, isn't it?
Yes, they get dementia more often and they get it earlier. Doesn't mean that all of them are going to have it, by any means. 7 of mine have had it. Interestingly enough, all the first 6 were high-grade women, and that's a bit unusual. I think not really a very significant finding, but it was very striking because nobody else has found that sort of thing either.
Do you mean they were less affected women? When you say high...
They were women who had been very well, had very high abilities before, and other people have thought that high ability saved you from dementia, but in my look, they were different.
Is there, in your general knowledge of this disability, is there a lower incidence of Down syndrome in society now than it was in 1963?
No, it's not. I think the incidence will almost certainly be the same. Even the prevalence, which is the ones who are alive, has altered very little. People thought it would go right down because there would be early identification, antenatal identification, and then people had terminations and you'd get hardly any people with Down syndrome at all, but that has not happened. A, they miss some because people have it younger when they don't have the test, and B, some people refuse to have it. They say, no, I'm going to have this baby, whatever.
Right.
Mm. So actually, it's, the prevalence has stayed pretty stable, pretty steady.
It has been fascinating to speak to you this evening, Dr. Janet Carr. We are joined on Ritz and Cures by Bill O'Shea and Dr. Nick Carr. Wonderful to have you with us this evening. Now that you've delivered the final part of this major 50-year study, are you going to hop the cap on the hook and put your feet up and go to a beach? Or what is the next right. chapter
You're
for you?
You're at a beach, aren't you?
I plan to write a rather general book. I've written several other books and papers, a lot of papers, of academic interest. This is going to be a general one, just for everybody. What the family's lives and what the people's lives were like, and mine too, how it affected me.
Wonderful.
So that's what I'm planning to do.
And someone's taken over the study too.
Yes, a professor at Birmingham University.
So they won't be left. They'll still have people looking after them.
I hope not. He'd better not.
We'll follow. Yep. I feel like Dr. Nick Carr's going to be doing it very well. Thank you so much for all of you joining this evening. Bill O'Shea, Dr. Nick Carr, and of course, the wonderful Dr. Janet Carr on Wits and Cures.